Celebration. The Central Pacific's extraordinary achievement had done more than give it the glory that Crocker and Strobridge sought. When the historic 10-mile day was over, the company's tracks stood within just a few miles of Promontory Summit. The last blow has been struck on the Central Pacific Railroad, and the last tie and rail were placed in position today, the Alta California proclaimed on April 30th. We are now waiting for the Union Pacific to finish their rock cutting. Only about 8 miles from the linking spot, the Union Pacific's workers were being forced to blast their way through the stubborn rocks of the Promontory Range that bordered Promontory Summit. Frustrated by having encountered this one last hurdle so close to the finish, Casement called on his men to make a final all-out effort. Between 600 and 700 graders and 100 track layers are working, and now only 25 feet of rock cutting remains to be finished, the Alta California reported. Work will be carried on all night, and by tomorrow noon the grading will be entirely completed. As the newspaper predicted, the difficult grading was indeed completed, the final tracks were laid, and 1 week after the Central Pacific's rails had reached Promontory Summit, the Union Pacific's tracks stood opposite them with only a 2,500-foot gap between. The most captivating race in the nation's history was over. Ironically, neither company could legitimately claim itself the winner. While the Central Pacific was the first to reach the linking site, the Union Pacific had laid the greatest number of miles of track. And, despite all the obstacles that both had been forced to overcome, and the incredible distance each had traveled, their final tracks had reached the immediate vicinity of Promontory Summit at about the same time. The stage was set for the linking of the rails. It was also set for the releasing of most of the men who had performed a construction miracle. On May 1st, hundreds of CP and UP workers lined up at their company's paymaster's cars and were given their final wages. Thousands more were told that they would be required to work only 1 week more. The two opposing armies are melting away, the Alta California declared, and the white camps which dotted every brown hillside and every shady glen are being broken up and abandoned. The Central Pacific Force are nearly all gone already, and that of the Union is going fast. An elaborate ceremony featuring the official joining of the tracks had been scheduled for May 8, 1869. The Central Pacific's president, Leland Stanford, arrived for the festivities that morning, but not in his accustomed style. He had planned to make a grand entrance in the Central Pacific's fanciest and most luxurious train. But en route, an enormous tree trunk had come crashing down on the train, and Stanford and his large party of Central Pacific officials and guests were forced to abandon it for a much less distinguished train that had been hastily summoned. Once he arrived at Promontory Summit, Stanford got another surprise. As soon as he stepped off the substitute train, Jack Casement informed him that the ceremonies scheduled for that day had been postponed until May 10th. The train carrying Tom Durant and other Union Pacific officials and their guests had been delayed by a washed-out bridge. Even though the bridge collapse had caused a delay, it was not the main reason Durant held up the ceremonies. On May 6th, after the washout problem had been solved, Durant had faced a far greater trauma. As his train was entering Piedmont, Wyoming, it was suddenly halted by an armed mob of angry Union Pacific workers. The men then switched Durant's private car to a sidetrack and chained it to a rail. Boarding the car, they took Durant captive at gunpoint, telling him that he would not be released until he paid them the large sum of money he owed them in back wages. Durant had no choice but to telegraph UP headquarters for the money. Only after it arrived and he turned it over to the disgruntled workers was he allowed to resume his journey and hastily make his way to the linking ceremony. For a spot that would be the site of one of the greatest moments in the history of the nation, Promontory Summit was a horrible place. Aside from its desolate location, it had only one street, and most of its inhabitants lived not in houses but tents. It did, however, have saloons, which had led to rowdiness not unlike that which had taken place in the Hell on Wheels towns. According to newspaper reports, 24 men were murdered in the whiskey-filled town in the 25 days before the two railroads arrived. But all that was forgotten as May 10, 1869, dawned bright and beautiful. By 7 in the morning, the first spectators for the event that would change America had begun gathering at the spot where the rails would be joined. An hour later, a UP construction train carrying graders and track layers who had delayed their leave-taking so that they could witness the great event arrived. Shortly after 10 o'clock, Durant's train, also carrying Grenville Dodge and Jack and Dan Casement, made its appearance. Along with these men, there was a battalion from the 21st Infantry Regiment and two different military bands. When all these latest arrivals had taken their places among the spectators, a group of the CP's Chinese workmen carefully graded the remaining section of land between the tracks of the two rival companies. Then they laid down the last ties and rails and drove in all but the final spikes. It was an extraordinary moment. "We stood with mouths agape," J.W. Malloy, one of the soldiers in the throng, recalled, as we realized that the much-talked-of line was completed. Grenville Dodge was equally struck by the moment and all that the Union Pacific had achieved, particularly in the last year's push toward the linking site. From the first day of April 1868 until May 10, 1869, only 13 months, he later wrote, "we built and laid 555 miles of track and graded the line to Humboldt Wells, making the total distance covered by our force 726 miles. And transported all the materials and supplies from the Missouri River. When you consider that not a mile of this division of the road had been surveyed until April, that we covered in that year over 700 miles of road, bringing all the material from the Missouri River, that we had to overcome its two great physical obstacles, two ranges of mountains, it was a task never equaled then nor surpassed since." With the two engines standing nose to nose, the formal ceremonies began. There were many speeches, all of them mercifully short, and several lively renditions of patriotic songs by the military bands. But the main event was the driving in of the railroad's final spike, a dramatic symbol that the Great Iron Road had been completed. It was no ordinary spike, but one especially created for the celebration. To fit the occasion, it was made of gold. "This spike," the Alta California informed its readers, "weighs about 18 ounces and is valued at $350, about $5,000 today. A nugget about 6 inches in length is attached to the head of the spike and will be broken off at the conclusion of the ceremonies to be made up into mementos." The following is the inscription: "The Pacific Railroad, ground broken January 8, 1863, and completed May 8, 1869. May God continue the unity of our country as this railroad unites the two great oceans of the world." Everyone present was well aware that this uniting of the two great oceans of the world had, in no small measure, been made possible by the rivalry of the great race. So no one should really have been surprised that it continued to the very last act of the adventure. The question of the hour was, who was to have the honor of driving in this final spike? Governor Stanford insisted that he should be the one. Tom Durant declared that he deserved to do it. The argument continued until just 5 minutes before the spike was driven. Finally, Durant gave in and reluctantly handed the honor over to Stanford. No one expected Stanford to be able to pound the spike in very far. A hole had been dug where the spike was to be inserted so that it could go in at least a little way, but no one expected him to miss the spike completely. Yet to the great amusement of the crowd, he did. Among the spectators amused was Alexander Tapance. A true American pioneer and mountain man, DuPont had been a cowboy, a stagecoach driver, a Pony Express rider, and a gold prospector. Later, in his autobiography, he described what happened when Stanford missed the spike. "What a howl went up," he wrote. "Irish, Chinese, Mexicans, and everybody yelled with delight, 'He missed it! Yee!'" Fully embarrassed, Stanford turned the sledgehammer over to Durant. And he also missed it. "Everybody slapped everybody else again and yelled, 'He missed it too,'" DuPont wrote. The sledge that Stanford and Durant had wielded was no ordinary hammer. Attached to it was a wire that led to a telegraph key operated by a man seated at a table close to the action. Of all those at the festivities, he was the most important. The entire nation was anxiously waiting for the news that the last spike had been driven, that East and West had been joined. In cities throughout the country, other telegraph operators were standing by, ready to receive the historic news, ready to relay it to the waiting crowds. As Stanford prepared to step forward, the operator at Promontory sent his first message. "To everybody, keep quiet. When the last spike is driven at Promontory Point, we will say done. Don't break the circuit, but watch for the signals of the blows of the hammer." As Stanford took up the hammer, the operator sent a second message. "Almost ready. Hats off. Prayer is being offered." Less than 2 minutes later, the wires came alive again. "We have got done praying. The spike is about to be presented." The wired hammer that Stanford had swung struck the iron rail instead of the spike, but the rail was actually an even better conductor of electricity than the spike. Immediately, the telegraph operator relayed the magic word, "Done." With this single word, the country exploded into one of the greatest celebrations it had ever had. In every city and town, church bells, fireworks, and fire alarms went off and lasted well into the night. Factory whistles sounded throughout the nation. In Philadelphia, the Liberty Bell rang. In Washington, a ball atop a pole set high above the Capitol building was dropped while thousands of people roared with delight. In New York, a 200-gun salute split the air. Omaha fired its own 100-cannon salvo. In Sacramento, 30 decorated locomotives, drawn up in a line, blew their whistles. No place in America was without its celebration. San Franciscans danced in the streets. People in Buffalo gathered together to sing the Star-Spangled Banner. The citizens of Chicago staged a spontaneous parade that stretched for 7 miles. In Salt Lake City, Mormons knelt down in prayer. Back at Promontory Summit, the festivities were not quite over. James Strobridge, Grenville Dodge, Jack Casement, and other officials from both the Central Pacific and the Union Pacific were given the honor of striking ceremonial spikes. The honor of being the last to hit a spike was given to Hannah Strobridge, in recognition of her being the only woman to have been present throughout the building of the road. One woman, however, was completely overlooked. No one had thought of inviting Theodore Judah's widow, Anna, who had so earnestly encouraged her husband, and who had actually accompanied him on several of his forays into the Sierras that had made the whole enterprise possible. Back in Greenfield, Massachusetts, Anna Judah was well aware of what was taking place clear across the continent. "The spirit of my brave husband," she would later write, "descended upon me, and together we were there unseen." When all the celebrations were over and the cheering had died down, there was time to reflect on what had been accomplished. General William Sherman, for whom Sherman Summit had been named, was unable to attend the linking ceremonies, but like Anna Judah, he had been there in spirit. The day after the final rails were laid, he wrote to his old friend and former military colleague, Grenville Dodge. "In common with millions," Sherman wrote, "I sat yesterday and heard the mystic taps of the telegraph battery announce the nailing of the last spike in the Great Pacific Road. All honor to you and the thousands of brave fellows who have wrought out this glorious problem, spite of changes, storms, and even doubts of the incredulous, and all the obstacles you have now happily surmounted." Many of the tributes were written by those who had been present at the final spiking. Captain J.E. Currier and his wife traveled from New Hampshire to be at the linking of the rails. "We have just witnessed the laying of the last rail," he wrote. "Truly, it is worth a trip from New Hampshire to see this alone. Natty and myself were permitted to give a stroke upon the hammer. I drove my spike with my sword hilt. Thus is the greatest undertaking of the 19th century accomplished. All honors to the resolute men who have put it through.